Welcome to Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you'd like to join us, please visit linuxlugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you're unable to join us in Mumble, you can listen to us streaming live. You can also join us in IRC on Freenode at @LinuxLugcast. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site and a mail list. Visit our website for the direct links. Tonight, we have a pretty packed room. I'm Father Finch, and I'll be your host tonight for episode 49. With me, in alphabetical order, we have 5150. Good evening, 50.
Howdy, folks.
We also have Phoebe. How are you, Phoebe?
Good opposite of morning.
Honky Magoo is here with us. Hello, Honky.
Evening.
Tonight, we've got a whole grab bag of topics, and we're going to start with our listener feedback. So, last show, we discussed Phoebe's grand plans for creating a distraction-free, on-the-spot mini PC for writing, and that solicited a lot of feedback. Phoebe, would you care to share?
Oh yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff came in. I think 5150 threw two separate links at me, which were very cool. And these are all going to go in the show notes as well. One of the ones that was really interesting was a link on the Adafruit website. Adafruit offers a lot of add-ons and stuff relative to Raspberry Pi and a lot of small board computing things. And they actually had a whole tutorial basically on a Raspberry Pi handheld palm top, which seemed particularly interesting. Also, he also found the link to the Zipit 2 that you mentioned in the last show. We also got an email from, and I'm trying to do these in chronological order, but I didn't look at the date stamp, so forgive me for getting you guys out of order. But let's see, we got an email from Thomas, and he actually wrote how to pronounce his last name in here, and I'm absolutely positive I'm going to botch it. So I'm going to say Thomas Nasser. And please correct me or find me and kick me in the face. In any case, he posted a really cool link. He says, long-time listener, first-time whatever is what he said. Anyway, I was listening to episode 48 where it was mentioned one of the hosts, which would be me, was in need of a small form factor writing station. And he did a very quick DuckDuckGo search and found this, a video workstation that fits in a 2.5-inch drive case. Specs include a Raspberry Pi A, a 500 milliamp hour battery, and a 2.0-inch screen. And the link he gives is a very, very detailed step-by-step instruction on how to put the thing together. Part of it does involve taking off a lot of the extra parts from the Pi A, so it may not be for the faint of heart, but the result looks very, very cool. It's very cool way of putting it together. And he said that the only possible drawback is that device may be too small for its intended use. It ends up being about the size of a smartphone, more or less. And once again, longtime listener, and gave us his name with proper pronunciation, which I'm sure I've gotten completely wrong. And so thank you for that. That was very, very valuable. And as a kicker for that, Dave Morris popped on and sent us an email that said, I don't know if this list contains anything of interest to interest in the context of our needs. And he posted a link to Linux Gizmos, which has 64 open spec, hacker-friendly small board computers. And that list, it just goes on and on. There are so many choices now for things that you can do just on the computing side. And that's not the display or anything else related to it, but this is just the computing side of it. And it's almost overwhelming if you click on that link and follow it down. So it's lots of good resources for that. He said that link was shared on the local Edinburgh HackLab mailing list. And even if it's the wrong answer, it might be a good answer to yet unasked questions, which, and actually what it's doing is making me want to make cool stuff for the sake of making it, which is very dangerous for me. So those were a set of the feedback we got pertaining to my question. And I guess in as we get into the show, I'll give a little recap of where that stands for me currently.
Well, yeah. That Adafruit article that I posted, I got that link from the Google Plus group for the new Podnuts' new mini PC podcast. We'll talk about maybe a little bit later in the show, but I just wanted to comment. The guy who posted it there, and I forget who it was, but somebody we're all know from podcasting. But he said, "Well, give me a little time because the case actually there is 3D printed, but the link does give places where you can go and have and send somebody the Thingiverse specs and have a case printed and mailed to you, but." The original poster said, well, I can see points where that case is maybe not as stiff as it could be, so give me some time to rework it. So if anybody goes there and is interested in that, you may want to check out the G Plus group for the Mini PC podcast. And also after that, there was a posting, I think, for one of the new 64-bit ARM processors, but it was more on the form factor of a Pi Zero, but it did have a USB port and an RJ45 port on it built in. And I was thinking, look at that. Well, that would be the one that I would build something like this around, because that's probably all you would need. With the USB, you could, you plug in an unpowered hub and actually make, paste that in along the side of the case and maybe add wireless if you wanted. So that got my mind thinking, but I'm probably not a good enough engineer to design a case.
Yeah. Looking at these, I've been very tempted to, were I to continue pursuing this, and I still may, design a case in Blender, of course, and, get that printed at Shapeways or someplace else and follow through with that. So I have some 3D printing projects I want to play with too. So too many things to want to get involved with.
Oh, that does remind me, and it's off topic, but I went to movie in the theater this week, and both of them had Cox ads for I think it's trying to compete with the Google internet. They're calling it Cox Gigabit or something like that. But then on, the whole kick they had on, which would have nothing to do with bandwidth, but they were showing people 3D printing food in a 3D printer. Sorry to keep putting in segues that have nothing to do with the topic.
That's all right. I'd still love to see a 3D printed.
Yeah, that could kick us off in a completely different direction about futurism.
Well, the talk about 3D printers essentially a replicator. Now we're doing food in them.
What is food but a molecular construct?
And what they showed either looked like very sugary things or it looked like homemade cheese doodles.
Well, to kind of rope us in or rein us in here. Perhaps it's the curmudgeon in me, but as far as a writing device, these mini PCs seem to be lacking the one thing that a writer needs, which is a comfortable input device.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that exact same thing when I saw the picture of the little homemade build one that 50 was just talking about, where it's you have that tiny, tiny keyboard. I mean, that's got to be hell to be trying to type anything out on, at least not for any extended period of time.
Yeah, a full-size keyboard is kind of one of those things that is, or at least as close to a full-size keyboard as you can get, is something I'm very interested in having as part of that setup. So, but the keyboard's a swappable thing. You can find kind of smaller form factors or that fold up or do all manner of crazy things to make them easy to pack, but give you close to a full board experience when you're actually using them. And any of these things, you know, you could extend them to use that kind of keyboard. You just have to, you know, figure out how it would attach and do a little bit of engineering when it comes to that.
Yeah, I've got a couple of these in front of me, wireless keyboards that are, you know, kind of like the form factor of a game controller, but smaller, you know, and they're fine for, I'm using the one on my, my quote Android computer, the Remix Mini, but it's okay, for doing web searches or typing something into YouTube that you want to find or whatever. But no, I'm not going to sit there and type a letter on these things.
And yeah, actually, I've got a friend who's planning on, you know, building his own mini PC with his nephew based on a Pi. And I have one of those keyboards, and I think Mark Rice recommended it. It's the Rye Mini X1. And I use it for what I use it. It's basically to push a couple of tunnels and connect a device to here or there. But I'm going to give it over to him, and I said the functionality as a keyboard is limited. You can type on it, but it's more like having a feature phone or an old BlackBerry where you've got the keyboard set, and you do have the mouse stuff, and it'll work, and it's cool to make a PC, but function-wise, it might not be the most practical thing. And he's like, that's awesome. That's just what we're looking for. We don't need to actually use the computer. We just want to build something that's cool. So it's exciting because it's getting getting younger people excited about the prospect of building something neat.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. Now, I can go in really quick, I guess, and say where I'm at, because it's not going to take a whole lot of time. I don't want to have a whole section dedicated to that. I can sort of give sort of the bird's eye, or should I just wait on that?
No, let's go ahead and take care of it now. I think that's appropriate to do it while we're already talking about it.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, the short version is I made an impulse buy. I was traveling for work, and I was at an airport, which is the worst place to make an impulse buy, by the way. But I ended up getting a verbatim folding Bluetooth keyboard. It's actually not a horrible little keyboard, and I got that and for use with my phone. And because again, I'm taking the easy way out, even though I'll probably still want to make one of these small form factor mini PCs at some point. But to in the spirit of making myself productive, I got a folding keyboard that works reasonably well with my phone. And I discovered Termux, which is an Android app for my phone, which gives you a real terminal with the ability to install programs via apt on it without rooting the actual device. And I'm kind of excited about it. I've been using it for about a week and a half, 2 weeks now, and I don't know if this is going to be the solution, but it's not a bad starting place for me.
Phoebes, I just had an idea occur to me, and of course, I wouldn't be able to do it because I'm not a touch typist at all. How about doing something with Google Cardboard where you would put your phone in a set of goggles, and that really would shut out the inside world, so all you would really need then is your wireless keyboard.
That's true, though I do tend, when I'm doing this mobile writing stuff, I do tend to be in a public space, so... Well, distraction-free writing is in the ideal case that would be the way to go. But there is for me at least, having some level of spatial awareness in public does just because I'll have a tendency to knock my coffee onto somebody walking by just because that's what I'll do. But I do have a cardboard and it is pretty cool.
I need to get one just to play with.
What have you done with it?
Mostly play with the default apps. I got it when I went to the Blender conference late last year, and everybody who attended the Blender conference got a Google Cardboard. And so being a 3D conference and people doing 3D content stuff, there was a lot of people who were dabbling in VR. And so they're shooting panoramas and sharing them back and forth, or a couple people already had a couple VR apps that they were sharing on them. So that that's what I've been using it for so far. I haven't done my own making of things in it as of yet.
Now, are you limited to the cardboard apps, or could you open up an editor in there, you know, and just do regular web things on it?
You should be. I mean, the cardboard device, as it were, is literally a piece of cardboard with two lenses in it. It's all about basically developing something with stereoscopic output that goes to a phone. So, I mean, anything that can do stereoscopic output, side-by-side stereoscopic output, and put that to an Android phone. I mean, technically, you could, if you just wanted to do a 3D video, you could use Google Cardboard for that and it would work just fine.
Yeah, but you couldn't open up like a notepad-like application in it.
You could. I'm not sure what you'd get out of it, though. I mean, it would split your amount of writing space for it in half, because you have to display it for stereo, for getting each one in each eye. You'd actually have to have one eye get half the screen and one eye get the other half of the screen. So the amount of columns you can type gets shorter by doing that.
Oh yeah, I can see that. You'd almost have to have a 3D aware one where they made it, you know, maybe made the characters thinner, and then when you perceived it, it would look normal.
You know, just give me a 4K phone, right?
Whoa. We're not getting that fancy. You should just open up a different text editor for each eye and write two books at once.
But yeah, right now my solution is rather mundane. It's a Bluetooth keyboard with my phone in Termux, and I think I'll end up recording some sort of podcast episode all by itself just about Termux, because I only recently found out about it, and that little app is kind of fantastic.
Well, I installed Termux based on your, I believe it was a G+ post, and I don't know what to do with it.
Well, I've got HTOP, Vim, Mercurial, and SSH and rsync running on it, which that's pretty much most of what I need for my productivity side of that.
Yeah, I need to do more research. I just installed it and then tried some commands and it didn't work. And that's because I didn't read anything about it and just jumped into the lake.
So this is essentially Tmux for Android then?
Yes. And I have a link for that in the show notes, I think. We had some other listener feedback though, yeah?
Yeah. I think it was the last show we talked about, maybe two shows ago, Sam contacted us with asking about his he had rolled at his own version of OpenSUSE with the Media Codex in there, and then we were discussing, well, if you've got proprietary codex in there, is it a limitation that perhaps you should be hosting it overseas? And I believe Sam came back and told us, well, he hadn't really considered it that much, but he wasn't too worried about anybody coming after a distribution that really that wasn't that widely used. And then we also had feedback from Ken Fallon talking about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and for pretty much anybody outside the United States, using restricted codecs wouldn't have any kind of penalty. But if we were worried about it, he included the link to where we could license restricted codecs, at least for the DVDs, to watch DVDs. And I followed that link, and I think it was 2.3 pounds, so, you know, less than $5 for to buy access to restricted codec. Of course, you'd have to do that on every device. Probably every time you switch distribution on a device, you'd have to redo it again to be legal. But yeah, I knew there was a way to do it, and Ken gave us the link.
Yeah, and in reading through that, I realized the error I had made in saying that Linux Mint was based out of Israel. It's actually, for those of us in the United States, it is on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, and it is A country that starts with I. It's actually in Ireland.
And, you know, Ken was saying, you know, I think he got the impression we're saying it was illegal for anybody to do it. But, you know, there may be other countries with restrictions, but definitely I think we all agreed that if you had some of those codecs in there, you would, and it was a popular distribution, you would probably want to host it offshore.
And again, this comes down to, you know, trade organizations or corporations that have limited control of their IP based on different global regions.
And the name of Sam's distribution, I meant to mention it. I had to go look it back up again. I looked it up right before the show and I forgot. It's Gecko Linux. And finally, on feedback, Kevin Wisher posted a question that he was trying. He had a bunch of photos he was sort of batch scanning in, and they were adding additional borders, and he had been trying to use a batch process to remove the extra borders, the black band or whatever around the photographs, and was having difficulties. And I believe it was Dave Morris came back to him, you know, with the specific arguments and switches that you needed to push into Image Magic to get that to work. And I think that's probably more detail than we want to talk about on the show on exactly how that was solved, because just glancing at it sort of made my eyes bleed.
Yeah, but I think we should put the thing that they came up with, the little script that they came up with, probably in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah. If you can cut that out of there and put it in, I think that's probably not a bad idea.
But then what incentive would people have for joining the Lugcast mailing group?
Well, just to get early access to this stuff. I mean, yeah, there a lot of stuff on the Lugcast mailing group is each of us trying to help other people solve their own problems, and this is exactly what was accomplished by this exchange of ideas. It's just I think we could do the whole show on just that topic, and I didn't read into it, you know. You guys may be able to carry on the conversation on that one. I just found those last couple posts right before the show when I was looking for links to put into the feedback, and I thought, wow, man, I'm gonna sit down and study this before I understand it enough to explain it to any listeners. So if there's somebody here who has looked at it and is confident that they can explain what's going on to the listenership, have at it.
Yes, that was a very detailed discussion that addressed a specific issue, and I'm sure that many people have encountered something similar. So that's the kind of stuff where you can get a lot of detail and get help from the community. But you're right, it addressed a specific need, and not as many people would do deep dive unless it particularly affected them.
Correct. But I figured we should add it in there in case somebody had that need as well. We can, I mean, we don't have like a link we can send somebody to that explains this. So if we just kind of throw it in there in the show notes, they can refer to that.
Yeah, but if anybody listening in the future would like access to that, we will certainly forward on the link or the mail chain so you can read through the whole thought process that went around it.
Or just join the mailing list.
And actually, the archives to the mailing list are publicly accessible.
There's that, too.
And the one thing I will also say is it's worth sharing that in there just because batch processing with Image Magic, it's one of those things where you'll see a lot of people, I got asked just this week by somebody if they were originally using Photoshop for changing the color profile of a photograph that they had taken, and they were going to do this for a whole series of photographs, and they wanted to Now, in Photoshop, you could set up an action and have it, you know, basically a macro to replay that sort of thing. But of course, you don't want to have just a license of Photoshop just to do that. And so they were asking me about scripting that in GIMP, which of course you could do that in GIMP too, but Image Magic's in command line, and doing that kind of batch processing with the command line with Image Magic, it's stupid easy, and it's, you know, that knowledge is really worth trying to get your head wrapped around, because if you ever end up doing a lot of image processing sort of stuff, Image Magic is beautiful.
One of these days I'm going to edit the thousands of photos I have. I will refer back to all of this information you guys have provided, but until that time, I'm going to run and hide from those pictures. And I believe that was all that we had for listener feedback, unless I'm mistaken, gentlemen.
I believe you are not mistaken.
Excellent. So we're going to move on to 5150, who has a plethora of links and information for us, starting with running Chrome OS on a regular PC.
Yes, I promised all three shows ago that I was going to do this by the next show. So finally, I have it working. Now, I'd mentioned before that I found a couple links on howtogeek.com and another one, Lifehacker perhaps, I think. But so now the way you do that is you go to this arnoldthebat.co.uk. And the link is in the show notes. And he's got his, it's Chromium OS, not Chrome OS. In other words, they're doing essentially, instead of using the Chrome code, they're using the Chromium code and doing the same thing that Google does. Because what we found out, or what I found out when I started looking, is that Google's Chrome OS is tailored to each specific Chromebook. So it's not like you can go to Google and say, I want to download Chrome OS and put it on my computer. So like I said, when I started looking, it seemed like everybody said, oh yeah, go this Arnold the Bat. But I tried, I mentioned and it didn't boot up once before with the 64-bit version. And what I'm working with here is a test system. It's an Acer Aspire, 2 gig of RAM, a dual core Atom processor. And it's designed to be a media machine that you plug into your TV originally. I'm not getting the double click. All right. But you know, it's not a real powerful computer, but as my understanding, all Atom processors were inherently 64 bits. So, and they use the, you know, the regular Intel processor image. So I download the 64-bit, and it got to where it said it was loading the kernel and just hung there. Okay, I thought, well, maybe I'll try the 32-bit version. So I reflashed the USB with the 32-bit, and it got a little bit farther. It got past all the text loading stuff in the beginning, and got it, you know, got to the Chrome OS splash screen and hung there. But fortunately, I've been listening to Linux for the Rest of Us, and a couple episodes ago they mentioned Cloud Ready OS. And Cloud Ready OS is really intended for schools to put on their older computers and turn them into Chromebooks. And there to schools, at least, there is a licensing fee associated with that. Apparently to individuals, there is not. I don't know what it is to businesses. I assume it would be akin to what they wanted to charge the schools. So there's a couple different downloads, and if you go, the company is actually called Neverware. So if you go to neverware.com/free-download, you'll be able to download a personal copy of Cloud OS. And I'm not sure if it's clear if there's any limitations on this as far as time or whatever, if it's a trial or if it's a full version. I'm pretty sure it's a full version. And you can run that right off the USB stick, which is what I'm doing right now. I haven't installed it to the hard drive. I'm running it off of the USB stick. Now, the next thing I said I was going to try to do, having done that, was install Crouton. Now, the problem I ran into that with that, actually, Chromebooks apparently to get into develop to put them into developer mode, you have to hold down Escape and then Reload and then Power button. And if you're wondering what's a Reload key, well, because you don't have a Chromebook, it would be a refresh. It would be like hitting the refresh button on your browser. There's an actual key for it. Since I'm using a wireless Logitech keyboard, I don't have that refresh key, and it's not clear if, even if I did, if Cloud Ready would respond to that, because I did find a forum post that's from a couple versions back where somebody was asking the devs, you know, how to install Crouton on Chrome OS, and the devs were, their first reply was, well, yeah, we may enable that sometime later on. It never occurred to us that anybody would want it. So I'm going to do some more research into that, but this discussion went down on, you know, edit, you know, what happens if I edit this config file and that config file. So these people are way more versed in the way Chrome OS works than I am. So I wasn't going to try to do that in the 2 hours before the show started and, you know, not knowing what I'm doing and risk not having the Chrome OS up and running, which I do have on this other computer here on the desk. So it's fast. I'd really have to run the two side by side to say if it's noticeably faster than, say, the Ubuntu that I've already got on the system. I do think it's quick, but pretty much what you have is three icons on the taskbar. One of them is rather than the Chrome icon, it's Chromium. And, well, every time you start the computer, you've got to put in your Google credentials, your Gmail credentials, and then you're in all your Gmail stuff by default, you know, so I can bring up my mail. I can, you know, I can bring up the Google Drive document that we use to plan the show. You know, everything that I could do from Google, I could do here. Now, okay, I'll test this here in a minute, because I'm not sure. I never tested to see if Flash worked in YouTube, because I did it. Well, I'll go, but there is a configuration I'll talk about in a minute that does, you know, show Flash installed. So, you know, if it doesn't work, I don't know why it wouldn't. The reason I question this, I tried this on another machine earlier today that was a desktop Core 2 Duo, and I tried Flash on it, say, you know, from the same USB stick, and it didn't work. So, or at least I tried to play a YouTube video. But essentially, like I said, you've got on the right hand side, you've got a search icon and the Chromium icon. If you hit the search icon, by default, it comes up with a list of a few of your add-on apps, and it's like the sort of default apps. If you open up a blank page in Chrome, you've got a few games and stuff that if you ever play with it, and if you go to Files, that essentially takes you to your Google Drive. So if I hit All Apps, then everything comes up, and I've got like Web Store. Like I said, two or three games or whatever that are installed by default, same ones you see in the Chrome browser. Files again, which of course would take you to your Drive, Google Sheets, Google Forms, Drive Notepad, Google Docs. You know, so all your Google Docs stuff. Video stream. Well, I added that. Well, yeah, local Chromecast. So you'll see your add-on apps. And I put a couple on there. I also installed the app for your Chromecast. That's on there too. Because if you're going to use this as a media machine and then send stuff to your TV or whatever, and you don't have the dedicated apps like you do in Android. So, you know, you need something to, you know, if you could find your content in a web page, where if it's like, you know, your TV shows and stuff, usually you can go to the website and play them there too, though I think it does it better in Android with a dedicated app. So if I were going to use this for something like that, I wanted that capability. And that's persistent. But like I said, your identity isn't. I just rebooted it, and I had to put my credentials in again. Of course, if I go over to the far right end of the taskbar, where it looks like just the calendar and the clock. And again, the clock is set to Pacific time zone every time I reboot the computer. So I'd have to go in to my settings. But if I click that, my options are sign out. It says connected to Ethernet, cast available, a volume slider, settings, which I'll get to, and then there's an icon for install cloud ready. So if I hit that, that would install it to the hard drive. And I do have the option, I looked on that other machine, I have the option, say you were wanting to do this on a Windows machine, you could install it as dual boot with Windows, and I assume also dual boot with Linux, if those operating systems were already persistent on the system. If I go to settings, there's settings, and underneath settings, advanced settings, and internet connection, media plugins, Flash was already installed, Widevine, I had to install that, I just went ahead and installed it. There's a thing that says click here to install Widevine, so didn't know why I would need it, but I put it on. Mouse, keyboard display, default search engines, sync, and then anything else, I have to go to advanced settings, and that's where, you know, I have to do to change the time zone, which I'll change to Central Standard while I'm here. Privacy and content settings, passwords and forms, fonts, accessibility, cloud, Google print. I tried that, but you know, I'd have to, before I could print to my printer, I'd have to set it up as a Google cloud printer in the first place. So in other words, anybody on the internet could print. Well, I assume you have to have credentials, but I don't have it set up so I could print to it from the internet. So there's no way, I guess, for it to just see, hey, there's a printer on this network, let's print to it. It's got to be a cloud printer. You know, decide, like every other browser, do you make it ask you the directory to put your downloads in every time, rather than just putting them all in the same place every time? On startup, I've got set to continue where I left off, rather than a specific start page, etc. So that's about as deep, I guess, as functionality gets in just Chrome OS. I mean, I can see carrying this around on a USB stick, maybe to you know, give me easy access to my you know, all my Google resources. But beyond that, I mean, if I'm going to carry around a USB stick, maybe I want a full operating system on it. So it's fun to play with, but you know, without being able to enable Crouton, I'm not sure if it's something that I would really use. Is everybody still awake out there? I keep having visions of, you know, from the airplane movie, when I get into one of these long soliloquies and I finally lit up on the button, that all you guys are like hanging from the rafters.
Still here.
Still here.
The breeze is keeping us moving.
Stepson in the chat says he's awake. Keep going.
Are there any comments? Does anybody want me to attempt to do anything in particular on Chrome OS to, you know, test its functionality?
Well, aside, it's funny that you are trying to run Chrome OS in an i86 format, because what a lot of the times in the community you see is people trying to find a Chrome OS machine or a Chrome OS capable machine, and they're putting Linux on it. So it's kind of like you're doing it backwards. Not you per se, but this project is.
I was actually thinking something similar. Like, basically, I'm trying to get Linux more Linuxy on my phone, and you're putting Chrome OS on a regular PC, which I love the symmetry of it.
Well, on that topic, Podnuts has been doing a lot of stuff playing with the Remix OS on an x86. I haven't tried that, but I mean, when we've talked about the Remix OS, on this show, a couple people have commented, well, that sounds like what Chrome OS should have been. I do think probably I would find Remix OS more useful. I'm not sure I wouldn't still find Linux more useful than either one. But I do have, after listening to Door, I do have coming. In fact, it should have been here today. I think it had a bounce back because it was looking for a signature and I wasn't around. The full 11-inch Remix Ultra tablet, which is, I think, better video specs, but essentially very much like the Remix Mini in specs and operating system, more of a desktop-centric take on Android. And Dor just raved about it. When I looked at the price, it was $300. I thought, maybe not. But then I saw it had GPS without having, without having cell service, it still had GPS. So I'm thinking, directions on 11-inch screen rather than on a 3-inch screen. I want to try that out.
And is Remix OS the kind of drop-in replacement where people are repurposing old hardware to be Chrome OS compatible?
Well, Remix OS is actually Android. So, you'd have all your Android apps.
Gotcha.
The other thing that came out after I made this order, and it was actually a little cheaper. Apparently, Canonical has come out with a Ubuntu tablet, which I've always said I wanted, and I think it's real Ubuntu. It's not the, I've always said the Ubuntu on the phones wasn't any better than Android, because still you're not getting your real Linux applications. It's just a framework under web apps. So from what little I've read, I think this is actually true Linux desktop on a tablet.
Yeah, there were an unusually large number of posts the past couple of days about the Ubuntu phone being ported to a couple of form factors that are, in mass production, as well as the new tablet thing. If this comes to pass, that's pretty awesome. Because when the Ubuntu phone was first announced, or the kind of convergence model, it was like, oh, finally, I only have to carry around one device. That would be so awesome to just have, the same underlying OS for all my devices. It just changes form factor depending on how you're using it. That is so awesome. So if this is true and it sticks to the, kind of what the community comes to expect from a Linux operating system, I see it taking off like gangbusters, at least for those of us who are wanting something like this.
Well, apparently, like the Remix tablet that I'm getting, it comes with a snap-on keyboard. I mean, I gather the one that I have for Remix is pretty much the same keyboard as the Microsoft tablet, the Surface. or very much like it. Now, I don't know how, you know, but essentially they're marketing this Ubuntu tablet is, you know, you take it someplace and you can assemble it and it'll be your laptop.
Yeah, that's what kind of kicks ass about it.
So I don't know. I mean, I may have buyer's remorse, though the Ubuntu tablet is not so terribly expensive. I couldn't get it as well. But I was thinking about, you know, the major things that I use my tablet for is pretty much pull up Hulu, you know, pick a show, and then send it to the Chromecast and then put the tablet back down. I, you know, occasionally I play with games on it, but... you know, there isn't that much that I do with it directly. I use it as the gateway to sending stuff to my Chromecast. And, you know, for that, the Android apps, frankly, I think work better than the Chromecast add-on in Chrome or Chromium. And I did test while we were talking on the Acer Aspire, even though it shows Flash installed, I'm not getting anything out of YouTube. You know, just a blank, you know, where the video should be just a blank screen. So, and that's weird because some at least, you know, I'm looking at like a Deadpool trailer, and I would think that would have been in HTML5 rather than Flash anyway.
Well, so you're trying to watch the video and it's just giving you a blank screen instead of presenting anything?
Yeah, there's not. It's just a black rectangle there. Nothing clickable. Nothing in there. So it's probably me, or maybe the developers didn't bake this entirely. But yeah, I would think that would be something. Well, does anybody here have a Chromebook? Or I'm sure Chromebooks would not be popular if YouTube didn't work.
Yeah, it seems it would almost be something with the hardware, with the drivers on the video drivers on that, because I've never really experienced that. Typically, when you encounter a video that your system can't play or is having trouble playing because of some compatibility layer between the browser or the app and the operating system, there's like a you're having a problem at this time, try again later type message. But just a black screen seems unusual.
Yeah, usually you see click to get this add-on, and it's like, well, that's not going to help me any because it's going to take me to the exe. But this is why we do these experiments, folks, so you don't have to. And I don't know if it would make any difference if I actually installed Cloud Ready to the hard drive. I rather doubt that it would. I don't know. Of course, there's nothing on that computer I really need to save, so I might do it anyway, but or I might try the dual boot.
Well, yeah, I mean, what type of form factor is it? Could you easily swap out the drive and just give it a shot?
I think it's pretty much meant to be a sealed box at the factory.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah, it's just a little dedicated media computer is essentially what it is. But it's, you know, since I've got it, I've been sort of using it as a test bed for different distros and whatnot.
Okay, sure. Cespin has an idea in the IRC that if you tried to play those links with MPlayer, MPV, or some other wrapper around MPlayer, whether or not it would work.
Well, see, that would work if I could install Crouton, and then if I had Crouton, I could use VLC or whatever to play it. But, you know, since I'm at the current configuration, I'm restricted to just pretty much what's available in the browser.
Well, your other option would be to force HTML5 in the URL path. You can add at the end of the URL, do ampersand HTML5 equal true, and I think it needs to be an uppercase T, and that'll force YouTube to use an HTML5 player. That at least, you know, will narrow down saying that, well, not having Flash is not your problem.
Yeehaw, that worked.
I'm useful.
I wouldn't go that far. Now, the other thing I did with that, like I said, I was trying to see if it would work on a slower computer. I've got a stack of, like, Pentium 4s here. And I hadn't looked at it that close. I didn't realize the one. I knew it was a higher-end computer, but I thought it was just a faster, Pentium 4. You know, I've got two or three Dimensions and an HP and that people have actually given me to get rid of. And I didn't realize when I pulled out of the pile was actually a Core 2 Duo. So it wasn't much of a different test over this Acer Aspire. So, after I tried it on it, then I said, well, let's see if it'll load on a Pentium 4. And I did try the Arnold the Bat 32-bit version and, hit the F12 to get it to let me select the boot drive. And it got like about halfway through the load up and stopped. So I figured, well, Arnold's not going to work on anything. And then I did use this Cloud Ready on the Pentium 4. And there's an initial setup where you can do your login, you know, to Chrome, or not to Chrome, to Google resources. In other words, your Gmail login. And it got past that eventually. And then it got to the screen where it was trying to see if it was the current update. And that seemed to hang. And then I clicked on, skip this step. But, you know, I was away for 40 minutes and it was still hung there. And I wanted to drive back to you, you know, have here on the show. So, I may try to see, okay, if I could, you know, boot it up and just leave it all day long and then do the install to the hard drive so things will go faster if it gets past that. But I'm of the opinion probably, you know, I would think maybe this would have been the target for this is, do something on old Pentium 4s that schools have that run XP and turn them into Chromebooks. I mean, if they've got dual-core machines, they're still going to be fairly snappy in Windows, and probably, unless they just, you know, want to convert them to Chrome, most of your multi-core machines are going to be at least Vista. So I'm not sure what if they're targeting this towards schools. I don't think there's going to be a very incredibly compelling reason for them to convert Vista and 7 machines over to Chrome OS, unless they just have, you know, they've gone to that paradigm where, you know, everything in the school is done through Chrome, which could, you know, done on Chromebooks. So that, you know, then I could understand it probably instead. It's, you know, using their existing computers instead of just buying a Chromebook for every student. So, so far right now is using this as rescue for a really archaic machine, I'd have to say no. I mean, there's versions of Linux that I could run, you know, perfectly well. Well, I don't know about perfectly well, but well enough on those Pentium 4s.
Right. And I think it was just, there are a lot of people who need something like something very confined like that, and it's a good way to try to test it out and learn how to do it. I mean, it is obviously not as functional as a regular full-fledged operating system or Linux operating system, but it's meant for those who need something more confined, and it's good to know that we can put it on a computer for somebody who needs something more confined, like your parents or your grandparents or your child who is just starting to learn and get into computers. You know, well, maybe your child, you want to give something more that they can grow with, you know, but, you know, just I don't know. I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing that you tried it, and it's a good learning exercise, and it's an operating system that's good for some people.
Well, Honky, you know, you I thought of that use case just as you were saying it, you know, that you know, after the 20th time you've cleaned viruses off Grandpa's computer, you know, just put this on there and tell him it's a new version of Windows, and he'll be able to get to his, you know, Facebook and all that stuff. Of course, he's going to call you and ask you where his solitaire is.
And they might have a solitaire you can add on there.
Oh, yeah. I'm certain you could probably, you know, have a link to some kind of online solitaire and just tell him, yeah, that's the new solitaire game.
Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, Chrome OS is definitely not something that you would want to put on to somebody who really wants to expand out and do something's machine. Chrome OS is something you want to put on somebody's machine who you want to confine as much as possible.
Right. I mean, it's not really for power users, though I'm amazed how many power users we know that say, yeah, I've got my Chromebook and I love it. But definitely you don't want a Chromebook to be your only computer.
Correct.
Okay. I also made progress on my home security project. Again, this is from a link from PodNuts' mini PC podcast. The link's in the show notes. It's hystou.com. And guys, don't run out and buy from this company. First off, the only practical way to pay them is PayPal. They don't have anything set up for credit cards. I mean, it's essentially either PayPal or Western Union. And they charge $5 to use the PayPal. Also, you know, when I went through checkout, and I should have, I usually always regret this. I should have created an account, and usually if I don't see myself ever making a purchase from the company again, then I do it as guest. So I went through as guest, and I did save a copy, text copy of everything on the, you know, on the, okay, your order is finalized page, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I ordered this a week ago. They said they would send me, you know, it said we'll send you a confirmation email, which I haven't seen yet. So I'm going to have to look at my PayPal later tonight and see if it's been charged even. It may be that it's there. They don't do anything till they actually ship the device. So if anybody looks at this link in the show notes and it looks good to them, I would say at least wait to hear the next show and see if I ever got mine. But what it is, it's a dual core Celeron. I got it with the one Door had in his links was just 2 gigs of RAM and no storage. I got it with 4 gigs of RAM and a 64 gigabyte SSD. And I just figured for my own home security, I can just put pfSense on it. And from inside pfSense, I could install Snort, which is the intrusion detection program. And I can install Squid, which is the web cache program. So hopefully 64 gig will be enough for that. If you go to Squid's wiki page, they say, well, we really can't tell you how much storage is enough and how much CPU and RAM is enough. It just depends on how much of a kick up you want. But the main thing about this computer was it came with on the board dual RJ45 ports, so you would have an input and an output port, and it also has dual Wi-Fi. So I still think I will use my router behind this, at least for the time being. So in other words, I won't be using pfSense as the router. This will just be a security device between the internet and my router. And we'll see how that goes. However, I'm still interested. I'm going to keep playing with my Banana Pi router because it, you know, this shipped, you know, with the shipping cost and the premium for using PayPal and all that was like $250 shipped, which is still better than the, you know, I think the cheapest one that you can get from directly from PF Sense appliance is like $300 for less specs. And I have seen a deal. I think it was a wrist processor, so more of a router-based device with DDWRT installed. But it had three RJ45 ports, but it was almost, you know, it was cheaper than this, but it didn't have as much memory. It didn't have any storage. So, you know, when he added the memory and storage to be equivalent to this, it was just as expensive. So I don't feel too bad about my purchase, assuming it actually shows up. But I mean, it's the, you know, PF Sense, it makes it dead simple as opposed to using like OpenWRT or whatever. But you know, I'm thinking of trying to develop something I can resell to customers, and you know, as a, if they're concerned about security, and I say, well, I can set you up with this security appliance, and I think they're, you know, I'm gonna have a lot of customers balk at $200 as opposed to under $100 for what I could probably do on a banana pie.
Well, it really depends on how big, you know, your customers are. If it's at somebody's home, you know, the banana pie is probably more than adequate. But if you've got somebody that's got a small business and maybe they've got, you know, a dozen machines on the network that need to access the internet, maybe this would be an alternative compared to some of the, you know, the out-of-the-box solutions from other companies.
Right. I don't know how scalable something like the banana pie would be.
Yeah, and when you're doing squid proxying, unless I'm wrong, you know, the amount of storage you need is based on what your browsing habits are, and typically this, you know, a single home, you know, is only looking to grab so much traffic that if you were to pull 64 gigs down in a day, that's a huge amount of traffic. So you probably wouldn't need that much. You know, you got to scale it to what you would do and how many times somebody's requesting the same data. So in a home environment, the banana pie seems pretty awesome, but I want to hear more about your experiences with this device.
Well, I've always been kind of skeptical about Squid because most of the pages I go to change every day. If they didn't change every day, why would I be going back to them? I guess there's probably a whole bunch of stuff on the back end that is boilerplate that gets loaded when you load a web page that might make it might make a difference, but you know, my Google Plus changes every day. My mail changes every day. Facebook changes every day. If I go to a news site or the weather or whatever, that changes every day. So I've got to wonder, you know, how much utility Squid's going to actually be to me.
Well, looking at it from just an outside perspective, and this is speculation without knowing much, which is what I'm apt to do. When you pull down a stream or a feed from a social network, you've got lots of existing posts that once you pull them down and you scroll through those posts, it has to repopulate your feed as you go through the older stuff. And that stuff can be cached. And so images in particular will be cached in the Squid proxy so that it'll display them quicker than having to re-download them as you're scrolling down the page.
Yeah, Kay Wisher's just chiming in the chat. He's got a 2 gig compact flash card, which is enough for Squid at home. I was wondering if 64 gig wouldn't be enough, but I didn't want to, you know, it got progressively more expensive. Now, as far as your trick feed for forcing YouTube to HTML5, autoplay was left set on by default. So once I played that initial video, it's still playing you know, at, you know, the next video and the next video and the next video as we're going, and it's, you know, and it's getting them. So either everything else on the internet, on YouTube was HTML5, or you really only have to do that once when you start, and then it that figures out from then on that you want HTML5.
Sweet.
Yeah, it sets a flag or a cookie in your browser so that it says request videos as HTML5 if the HTML5 format is available. You'll encounter on rare occasion videos that are not HTML5 compliant, and you won't be able to watch them.
Well, I need to do that on my regular machine then.
One of those rare moments when you're not cursing the existence of cookies.
Okay, and the last couple things I had, we've already mentioned the new Podnuts Mini PC podcast. There's also, there's only one app out yet so far, lilliputing.com, which is a resource a lot of us watch for our mini PC, you know, see what's new in mini PCs. They have a new podcast, and the link is there in the show notes. I'm not going to read it out. So now, for warning to those of us who criticize when we talk about anything but Linux, both of these shows have talked about mini PCs with a version of Windows installed. Now, you know Podnuts, probably every time Dor has to talk about Linux, he's shaking his, or rather, every time Dor has to talk about Windows, he's shaking his fist at the screen the whole time. So I doubt, you know, I wouldn't expect a whole lot of Windows content, but this is mini PC is in the form factor, and these do include, you know, machines as large as the one I'm, you know, the dual core Celeron that I bought for pfSense, or the aforementioned Acer Aspire Media machine that we, you know, that we've used as the that we've been experimenting with Cloud OS on this evening.
Now, real quick, the putting pfSense on the Banana Pi. Do we know? I know that we found one thing about how to put IP Fire on the Banana Pi, but do we know how to if there's one on how to put pfSense on a Banana Pi?
No, pfSense is AMD Intel only.
Okay, and when it comes to putting the IP Fire on the Banana Pi, you needed that that connector that you had to attach to it, which was a parallel to USB connector or something along those lines that you had to attach to the pins just to be able to get your first connection to it.
Yeah, there was something like the video wasn't working for him, and also he tried to install Snort, to enable Snort, and it just died right away, so there was a bug. I don't know if that's been fixed or not. I was going to go ahead and play if they opened WRT.
Yeah, I played with the open WRT, and I didn't have too much luck with it, but you might have better luck with having the, you have the one that's set up as a router, right?
Yeah, the main thing is I'm not getting any video out of it, and the other thing was I expected it to show up on my other router as an attached device, and since it's expecting to be a router on the WAN side, it's not connecting. Now, if you connect a computer to it on the LAN side, and then you go to, you know, you go to your .1 address, there it is. You can see a web page, ask for a login. But the trouble is, most open WRTs, I think it's the login is either user admin password admin or user admin password blank. And it's not that on the version of open WRT that I downloaded and installed, and I haven't been able to find what the password actually is yet. Not that I've done an exhaustive search yet. And there are more versions of WRT, Open WRT, that I found for it. There's actually a later version, but there was like version 3 or dot 3 or whatever advanced. So I and there was dot 4 didn't say advanced, so I went with the dot 3 advanced. And but I rather expect login is going to be the same on all of the OpenWRTs that have been written for the Banana Pi. So if anybody's privy to what that login is, let me know. But like I said, I don't think I've done an exhaustive search yet to determine what, you know. I haven't given up on finding the login online.
Yeah, if you had asked me like a couple months ago, I would have had that for you. But it's been a while since I was playing with it, and I completely forgot what they were. It should be like right around where you got the where you downloaded the image from.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. All the images for the Banana Pi are up on somebody's Google Drive. It's almost sketchy looking.
I guess you could probably check the OpenWRT site, and they'd give a listing of all their known devices and stuff like that. And they usually give a nice like how to install stuff, and they should have the password probably on there.
Okay, I'll check that out because I said, you know, the sites that lead, you know, that have the link, have the download link, you know, are where I'm getting admin and blank or admin and admin. From, and neither of those seem to work. Okay, I think really that's all I had. I think, Fweeb, did you say everything you wanted to on your writing appliance?
Yeah, as I progress with it, I'll keep reporting in future shows, but I think we're pretty much covered from this point.
Okay, well, it's over to you, Honky.
Well, I think we're running a little bit late. I think we'll just kind of save that for next time.
Okay, great.
All right, does anybody have any final thoughts for the night? All right, I'm going to sing us out then. Well, thank you all for joining us today on this show. Our next recording date is February 19th, 2016. The music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. Special thanks to Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting, WordPress support, email list server, and a nice script to keep our IRC bot connected. Additional thanks go to Delwyn for providing the Mumble server we use and for creating a bot module to find the next show recording date. Type .ns in the IRC command line. I've been your host, Father Finch, for the evening, saying good night. Good night, gentlemen, 5150.
Night, folks.
Fweeb.
Good night.
Honky Magoo.
Have a good one.
And I'd like to reiterate that all are welcome to this show. Any ideas and opinions about open source, free software, or anything that might pique your geek interest are welcome. Just contact us. Have a good week.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio-only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget, the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Blindridge, he's a bloody drunko.
If you don't like a gas, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies, that'll link it back.
G'day, my name's Jude, or better known as Mrs. 64. Hacker Public Radio needs your help. They're running out of shows. If you ever thought you'd like to contribute or do a podcast yourself, here's your chance. Come on, Hacker Public Radio needs you. If you think you're going to sound silly or not going to sound like you know what you're doing, think again, because it never seems to stop my husband. It's easy, and if you live in the USA or the UK, it's as simple as picking up the telephone and phoning the call-in number to record a show, or plugging in a mic and opening Audacity. Get over to hackerpublicradio.org/contribute.php.